You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 28th of November, 2013, on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24 live from Studio One in London with me, Chloe Potter, and Phil Hahn.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we'll be setting the day's news agenda with the editor of Think Africa Press, James Schneider. James, what do you have for us today?
Big news in Nigerian politics as the country's ruling party splits for good. Mali's 2012 coup leader has been arrested in the country's capital, Bamako. And terrorism joins fear of genocide in the dominant narratives about the Central African Republic.
Thanks very much, James. Plus, the crackdown continues in Egypt. We'll find out why seven teenage girls are being sent to prison and if this is merely Mubarak 2.0.
And time to go for a drive. Well, at least try to. We're in Brazil to see whether the Grand Prix is really all it's cracked up to be.
It's such a big mess for 2 months before they start to put the guardrails. The roads are narrower, there is less place to park the cars, and it's quite difficult.
Also, do you sometimes feel like your life is being taken over by stuff? Well, relief is in the air as clutter is out and minimalism is in.
That does sound good. Well, there's lots to come in the next hour here on Midori House. We'll also play some music and look through the French front pages as well. All to come here on Midori House.
But first, let's get the headlines with David Spencer.
Thank you. Monocle 24 News, I'm David Spencer. Protesters in Bangkok have continued to call for Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawat to resign despite her defeat of a no-confidence vote. The Prime Minister holds a clear majority in Parliament and was always expected to overcome the motion brought by the opposition. The vote, though, is unlikely to end the demonstrations, which are now into their fifth day. Although peaceful, the protesters have managed to disrupt many government departments, including Thailand's equivalent of the FBI. Police in the United States have arrested a couple after claims by their three daughters that they were effectively held captive for 2 years. It's claimed the girls, aged 12, 13 and 17, were malnourished and hadn't been allowed a bath for 6 months. Officers were called to the house in Tucson, Arizona on Tuesday after two of the girls escaped and told a neighbor their stepfather had tried to attack them with a knife. Tucson Police Chief Roberto Veraceno believes the girls were forced to live in filthy conditions.
In addition, the video surveillance was obviously set up by the parents, and that was set up just on the rooms of the juveniles. The cameras were focused on the beds of the juveniles, and they were on 24/7 from what we could tell.
There have been protests in Honduras after Conservative ruling party candidate Juan Hernandez was declared the winner of Sunday's presidential election. The result has been disputed by leftist candidate Xiomara Castro, who claims the election was riddled with fraud and corruption. Australia has summoned China's ambassador to express concern over Beijing's air defence identification zone over the East China Sea. The move by China raised the stakes in a territorial standoff between Beijing and Tokyo over islands in the area. The United States defied China's demand that planes flying there should identify themselves to Chinese authorities by sending two unarmed B-52 bombers over the islands on Tuesday without informing Beijing. Australia's Foreign Minister Julie Bishop underlined their concern about China's actions.
I'm following long-standing Australian policy in raising our concerns over action taken by China to announce an air defence identification zone without warning, without notice, without consultation. And I think we were quite right to raise our concerns. We called in the Chinese ambassador to Australia to ask him to clarify the situation and to explain the timing and manner of the announcement.
President Barack Obama has telephoned Saudi King Abdullah to discuss the interim deal between Iran and six world powers to curb Tehran's nuclear program. The president emphasized that it will be important for Iran to follow through on commitments made in the deal. Saudi Arabia had given its qualified approval to the agreement earlier this week, but has concerns about Iran's improving relations with the US. Obama and the king agree to talk regularly as negotiations continue on a longer-term agreement. Drivers who break the law on Indonesia's roads will soon have a new force to reckon with, fellow motorists. Police in what is one of the world's largest and most congested cities, Jakarta, will launch a social networking website next month to allow residents to post photos to name and shame those that break the rules. Laws often ignored include a years-old ban on using the city's main thoroughfare during rush hours with less than three people in a car. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, David. It is 5 minutes past the hour here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Welcome back. You're listening to Midori House live from Studio One here in London. Time now to set the day's news agenda. We're joined in the studio by James Schneider, editor of Think Africa Press. Welcome to the program, James. A little earlier, you were mentioning some developments in Nigeria. Tell us some more.
Yes. Yeah, so Nigeria's ruling party, which has always claimed to be Africa's largest political party, earlier this year, 2 months ago, it split in half. Pretty much, where the rebel grouping, which took seven of the country's governors with them, a former vice president, a lot of senators and a lot of representatives, split over worries about the leadership of the president, Goodluck Jonathan, his desire to run for president again in 2015, and also the chairman of the party, how he was running it, and they say breaking internal party rules. And then yesterday, the rebel faction within the party has joined with the opposition alliance, which actually means that the opposition alliance now has the majority of state governors. It now has a majority in both houses, in the Senate and in the House of Reps. And this this is really a kind of a big earthquake in the Nigerian political scene.
President Goodluck's people are saying he doesn't feel threatened, but what's this going to mean for him?
Well, if he doesn't, he should, because he now doesn't control pretty much all of the biggest and most important states. He didn't control Lagos beforehand. He doesn't control Rivers, which is where a lot of the oil comes from. He doesn't control Kano, which is the biggest northern city. So he really should be worried. He should be worried if he does stay the candidate of his party, that he could very well lose the elections in 2015. Or some people within his party, like former President Obasanjo, could see that, okay, well, the way to save the party really is we've got to remove him. That'll bring back the splitters back from the opposition alliance, and that will save the party. But really, he's not in a good spot.
How much of this could be prevented by Goodluck Jonathan simply saying he's not going to run once again? Because the leadership is supposed to alternate anyways between Christian and Muslim leaders.
Yeah, it would go quite a lot of the way. So this alternating thing it's an informal agreement within the party, within the ruling PDP, with the return to an electoral system of government in 1999. They said that, right, basically every two terms they would swap. And there was a problem because Goodluck Jonathan's predecessor, who was from the north, died in office. Mm. So he became, and he's from the south and he's Christian. If he were to say, right, I'm not going to stand in 2015, then I imagine quite a few of the people who have presidential aspirations or vice presidential aspirations who've joined APC might go, that's the opposition grouping, might go back to the ruling party, the PDP, in order to contest the primaries. But now there might be too much water under the bridge even for that.
James, moving on to your next story, chaos, complete chaos in the Central African Republic. Bring us up to date on that.
So things are really pretty bad in the Central African Republic. Something like over 400,000 people, which is around a tenth of the population, are displaced. There are lots of reports coming out of violence, killing, that sort of thing. The French force there, they're 400 there at the moment. That's being beefed up to around 1,000, a little bit over 1,000. But that's really just going to focus on protecting roads, trying to nudge the Central African force that's there to kind of be a bit more proactive and defend French interests and French assets. The thing that came out yesterday and that there are now starting to be whispers about is terrorist groups picking up in the, you know, doing something in the region. There's no evidence for it at all. There's no evidence that there is any of this, but there seems to be a real concerted attempt on the part of some people within the UN and some people who are concerned about the Central African Republic to really push the hot buttons for Western newspaper editors and Western interests. So that's why genocide, I think, has been talked up so much when it isn't happening and it really isn't very likely at all. And now, you know, what's the other big hot button issue, especially after what went on in Mali, is the threat of terrorism and ungoverned space. So a lot of the narrative that's been created about the Central African Republic says a lot more about us than it does about the situation on the ground.
Well, the UN, they're warning that this could potentially spiral into another Rwanda. Although it is a very different situation, the situation in the Central African Republic still is a sectarian conflict between Muslims and Christians.
No, not really. Well,
that's what the UN says.
Yeah, and no, but that's my point. So this is being used in order to gain interest and support because things do need to be done and it is getting more people to look at the country. But just narrowing it down into being a Christian Muslim thing doesn't really work because one, yes, the majority of the Seleka rebels, the rebels who are now swelled in numbers and are doing a lot of this fighting, going around in gangs and acting like bandits. Yes, a lot of them are Muslim, which means that, and the majority of the population, about 90% of the population are Christian. So that means that it is Muslims mainly attacking Christians and then Christians defending themselves against Muslims. But that doesn't mean...
Because they are setting up local militias, armed militias.
That doesn't mean that this should be necessarily viewed through this idea that the Muslims are trying to kill the Christians because they're Christian or the Christians are trying to kill the Muslims because they're Muslim. To some extent, these pre-existing divisions, which also have ethnic and historical basis as well, are being instrumentalized for the violence. But just to see, these are kind of deep-seated hatreds between two religious or ethnic groups that just want to kind of get after each other is not true. And also the you know, genocide means the concerted attempt to wipe out a group of people based on their religious beliefs, ethnicity, or political beliefs. And that isn't what's going on. What we're seeing is far more chaotic. It's far less organized. And it really doesn't fall under that rubric.
And finally, James, turning to Mali, where the March 2012 coup plunged the north of the country into mm-hmm. chaos, there's been an arrest there, the leader of the coup.
Yes, so formerly captain, now Lieutenant General Amadou Haya Sanogo has been arrested for a series of things. So he's been accused of being involved with disappearances, kidnapping and murder, specifically in relation to a kind of counter coup that took place in April of last year, and also to do with a mutiny that happened in a particular barracks where he was living and where some of his support base was, which happened a couple months ago. So he's finally been taken, and this has been a kind of bit of a dance between the judiciary and him over the last 2-3 weeks, where they've been putting out reports saying, we're investigating him, we're about to arrest him, and so on. And then he would respond by saying, well, you can't arrest me, I'm a former head of state. Or earlier this week, the judge who's investigating him, his son got beaten up and he got his motorcycle taken. So there's been this kind of dance between the two of them. And then yesterday... armed men came into his house. He was forced to move from his barracks to Bamako. They came into his house and they forcibly arrested him, and he's been charged.
James, excellent set of stories from the African continent as always. James Schneider, editor of Think Africa Press, thanks for joining us.
Coming up, we'll be in Egypt to find out why 7 teenage girls are going to prison.
Weekend Edition is the perfect way to wind down from your working week and prepare for the days ahead. Every Saturday and Sunday, we bring you a mix of new music, global front pages, insightful interviews and lively guests.
He just gets better and better. He's really terribly good. And so it's absolutely aggravating and brilliant, of course.
There's also the usual eclectic mix of Monocle 24 programming, a look back at a few broadcasting highlights, and a preview of some of the shows to come.
This is a film that took 3 years to make. We travelled to 10 countries. There's over 20 different stories in the film about people interacting in one way or another. The scope of it is pretty massive.
That's the Weekend Edition with me, Georgina Godwin. All day Saturday from 8 a.m. and on Sundays from 1600 hours London time, right here on Monocle 24.
Learning from a master is a privilege in any sphere. To nurture ideas for the arts, Rolex's Mentor and Protégé initiative has been teaming leading practitioners with promising protégés around the globe. Monocle's culture editor Robert Bound hopped over to Venice to talk to some protégés and mentors.
Everybody's moved out of institutional thinking and behavior and moved into something that's way easier, more honest, more direct, and more collaborative. As an artist, it's not interesting to be a private genius. What you want is to be part of a movement.
You can watch Rob Bound's film on monocle.com.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Chloe Potter, and Phil Hahn. It's coming up to 10:17 in Cairo, 9:17 in Rome, and 8:17 here in London. But it is to Cairo where we're going to be heading next. Now, it's been 5 months since the Egyptian army overthrew the democratically elected government of Mohamed Morsi. And in those months, the crackdown on dissenters continues to intensify.
Earlier this week, the military-backed government passed a law effectively making it illegal to protest in the streets, with penalties including time spent in jail. Just yesterday, a court sentenced 21 female supporters of Morsi to 11 years in prison. Well, to get more on the situation in Cairo and across the country, we're joined on the line by Monocle contributor Abdelrahman Hussein. Abdelrahman, many thanks for joining us here on the program. The crackdown continues there in Egypt, and it seems to be getting tighter and tighter.
Yes, indeed. We must note, however, that the female protesters, most supporters who were sentenced, they were sentenced not under the new protest law, but they were sentenced on other charges, very frivolous charges, to be honest. They were trying to form a human chain in Alexandria, and that's where they were swept up by the police. Many of them are minors, and they've been handed out sentences ranging from 11 to 15 years, which means the minors will be spending it in a juvenile detention facility. So this has caused a lot of ire, obviously, and it comes right after the protest law has been passed. What happened with the protest law was that it was put into effect the day before yesterday. During that day, an organization which is against military trials in Egypt went out to protest the protest law against it. They're not affiliated to the Muslim Brotherhood in any way, and they're not supporters of Morsi. The police dispersed the protest very violently, and the irony in this is that during the dispersal, they actually broke many of the laws included in this draconian protest law, because for example, their police have to be in uniform while they're dispersing the protest. They were not. They have to give audible warnings, repeated audible warnings before dispersing the protest. They did not do that. They arrested many activists, many of them female, and they eventually ended up throwing the female detainees in the desert later on that night. So what happened was yesterday, in response to that, there were further protests that were called. They did take place in downtown Cairo, near Tahrir Square, but not in Tahrir Square, which is closed off by the army. And the Ministry of Interior came out right before it and said that this protest had been authorized, even though no one had actually submitted any request for its authorization. So it's been quite a farce, and I don't think this protest law will hold on, to be honest.
Abdel, this draconian approach, it's questionable, surely, not good PR for the military, surely, setting themselves up for a fall.
You're completely correct, but I think the military is at the stage that and the interim government that it backs, they're not very interested in good PR, especially abroad. What they care about is their image within the country, and they still do have support, and they do have support for these draconian actions to be taken against, in part, Morsi supporters or anybody else who wants to protest. But however, they've built a rod for their own back, and it's going to be challenged very severely. And I don't think it's going to hold up. It's already been flaunted. I mean, people who want to protest are protesting, and they're saying, you know, there's no protest law that's going to stop us.
Abdel, the more you look at this situation, it essentially looks like this is, we're back at a time when Mubarak was in charge in all but name. You have this authoritarian government in charge, protests aren't being allowed. But I'm wondering, is that perhaps a good thing? Because it seems, in a sense, there is a bit of stability that's back in the process there in Egypt, and especially in Cairo. You know, we're not seeing tens of thousands of people on the streets of Tahrir Square. We're seeing people going back to work, the markets are back open. So is this, just taking the other side of this argument, is this a potentially good thing?
Not at all, because it's a false stability, because firstly, it does hurt the work era, this action of the Interior Ministry of throwing people in the desert. 20 kilometers outside of Cairo was a very common act in the Mubarak era. This enforced stability that comes after great violence, does not last. We've learned in the past 3 years that this stability that comes through extreme oppression is always a mirage, and it's always sort of kind of builds up a pressure point for an even bigger explosion down the road. And so I doubt it will last.
As you say, it does seem to be an unsustainable approach. How do you see this playing itself out?
Well, it depends on what happens next. I think the government will probably try and back down. The Prime Minister already talked about amending the protest law. But the issue is that the problem is that it's an unreformed Interior Ministry, which is supposed to implement the law. And if the body that's supposed to implement the law does not in and of itself respect law, then no one else will. And it'll just create a situation which will lead us back to, you know, further and further dissent. And rightfully so, because this situation is not sustainable, and that there's too much oppression and too much injustice at the moment.
Abdel Rahman Hussein, Monocle contributor in Cairo, thanks so much for joining us.
Welcome back. You are listening to Midori House. The time is 8:23 in the morning here in London. It's time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. Today, we're headed to Italy.
And joining us on the line from Milan is our man there, Ivan Carvello. Ivan, thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
There is one story dominating everything, isn't there?
Indeed, one man who's dominating the headlines, and that man is Silvio Berlusconi. Today, ex-Senator of the Republic, who is now a common citizen.
Are we finally ready to move on to a new phase of domestic Italian politics? Are people there just fed up and they want to move on? They want to plan for the future of their country without having to deal with these scandals?
Yeah, Phil, that's the million-dollar question right now. But while Berlusconi is no longer in Parliament, we have to remember that he does wield quite a bit of influence. He is still the leader of Forza Italia, his political movement. They're polling about 15% right now. And at the moment, if Enrico Letta's government, because Enrico Letta now has the support of a center-right faction that split, and as we know, Alfano split from Berlusconi, if that government can pass some key reforms, we may be able to turn the page of the Berlusconi era. I think right now Berlusconi is going to wait in the wings, use his political movement. He still has, of course, a lot of influence. You have to remember media power. He can get on television because he owns three networks. He has the newspapers. So we have to be careful about counting Berlusconi out. That's the problem. He won't be in parliament in the future because there is a ban for 2 years that he will have to serve out of public, so he can't be in public office. But of course, he can be leader of a movement because we've seen Beppe Grillo, a comedian, outside of parliament, but leading a very populist movement, which is actually the single largest party in the parliament.
Berlusconi might be trying to model himself on that as leader of his party, but is it really going to be possible for him to remain at the head of the party when he's facing many more criminal charges to come?
Yeah, he's going to have to face, as you mentioned, some other trials, because he is facing several at the moment. He's going through appeals, for example, on the famous trial that revolves around the Bunga Bunga parties and the paying of sex of a minor for sex, and that case is going on. If these things are, you know, keep coming out in the press and damage him, he may decide to pull back. But you know, he's a political animal, Berlusconi, and even if he can't serve in parliament, It's very difficult to count him out. I mean, if Letta's government doesn't get through some reforms at the moment, then we may see a bit more support for, you know, somebody on the center right. If Alfano cannot fill that vacuum, this is the point where Alfano has to step in and say, we are the alternative on the center right, so the electorate can look to us, and the Berlusconi era has passed. If Alfano can step up to the plate, then we may just see Berlusconi recede into the shadows.
Ivan, it's interesting you mentioned there whether Letta's government will indeed pass some serious reforms in the next little while. There was an interesting article in the Wall Street Journal this week with the headline, "Is Italy Facing the Stability of the Graveyard?" They argued that the government's only been able to remain in office by attempting little and achieving even less. Do you think that's a fair statement?
Well, you know, on Tuesday, so the day before the vote to expel Berlusconi, Berlusconi, of course, pulled his Forza Italia party out of the Grand Coalition government. There was a confidence vote in the Senate on the 2014 budget. Letta won that vote. And at the moment, he also canceled a very unpopular property tax, which is something that Berlusconi had rallied around for months, saying, you know, this is something that was from the Monti caretaker, technical government, and that has been cleared off the plate. Letta says we're not going to have that second property tax, which is very unpopular. If he can keep this sort of momentum, pass a very important electoral law reform, which is something that Napolitano, the president, wants the government to pass in December, which will allow a very simple majority to form a coalition, because right now the electoral law we're using is in Italy is from Berlusconi's sort of era of 2005, which makes it very complicated to form a coalition. If Letta can get those reforms through into 2014, then we may see some more stability, but he does have to obviously offer more to the business community, because right now there's very little in the budget that cuts the very expensive public administration. So we're going to have to see some more courage on that front from Letta's government.
And in the wings, that I'm sure that colourful Berlusconi drama is far from over. Ivan, moving on to a different story, a consumer story. Car sharing services are on the up in Milan. Tell us about that.
Yeah, in Milan, we have a congestion charge like in London. It's been going on for a few years now. And so traffic is down, and there's been a lot of boom in these car sharing services that have been offered. Mercedes, through their Car2Go with the small little smart cars, is a service that was recently introduced. And now Fiat, which has been hurting with car sales in Europe, it's out of the top 10 brands in Europe, and in Italy it's been suffering through the economic crisis because people aren't buying. And they've been working with the Eni, the state, the former state energy company, oil producer, to offer 600 Fiat, the little Cinquecento models, which are kind of popular now. And this is another service that the mayor, Giovanni Pizzapia, is offering to sort of promote the use of car sharing. So it helps the automakers. It also helps the environment here because we have less people driving their own cars, and so just as they need it. And so this is becoming into service at the end of December, so it's a good thing for the city, I believe.
And Ivan, just very quickly, it's nearly winter. Well, I think it is winter here in London. I think Chloe and I wouldn't mind to have a Moncler jacket or two, but it seems like we're not the only ones.
Indeed. The Moncler, which was originally a French company for outerwear and is now owned by an Italian, Remo Ruffini, is expected to list on Milan Stock Exchange. So some good news for the Milan Stock Exchange, which has been trying to attract fashion brands to list, to say, look, this could be a financial, this could be a hub for luxury goods brands. We've seen some recent successful listings, Brunello Cucinelli, which is a cashmere brand based here in Italy, what's quite popular, very expensive, but very nice cashmere. So Moncler is hoping to test the waters in December with the listing. So there'll be hopefully for you guys in London, more offerings, more stores perhaps to get those puffy winter jackets.
Lovely. Thanks very much, Ivan. Ivan Cavallo there, our Milan correspondent.
And in the next half hour of the program, we'll be getting a check of the French front pages, and we'll ask you why you need to declutter your life, and also... We will try to go for a drive at the Brazilian Grand Prix. But first, here is David Spencer with the news headlines.
Thank you very much indeed. Thai Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawat has called on anti-government demonstrators to end their protests and hold talks to avert street confrontations. In a televised address a few hours after easily winning a confidence vote in Parliament, she said the rallies were hurting the economy. A couple have been arrested in Arizona on suspicion of holding their daughters captive in the family's home for up to 2 years. It's claimed the three sisters were kept in filthy conditions, with the girls complaining they'd not been allowed to wash for months. The former Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi described his expulsion from Parliament as a day of mourning for democracy. The vote by senators strips him of parliamentary immunity, meaning he could face further charges. He's already been convicted of tax fraud. The Syrian National Coalition opposition group says it will attend fresh talks in January aimed at ending the civil war, having previously demanded certain preconditions before attending. The coalition also said Iran should only be allowed to attend if it withdraws its forces and those linked with it from Syria. The government in Sri Lanka has announced a survey to determine how many people were killed during the country's 26-year civil war. The census will try and collect information on the number of deaths and missing people between 1983 and 2009. Canadian pop star Justin Bieber has been asked to clean up his mess by the mayor of the Gold Coast in Australia after he spray-painted a hotel wall. A picture of the graffiti was posted online, but Mayor Tom Tate described it as an eyesore and sent Bieber a clean-up kit to remove it. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, David. Justin hasn't had the easiest of rides lately, has he? He's been in trouble a lot.
He's a naughty boy.
He's been caught urinating in restaurants, spitting on people off the balcony.
And he wore a very dodgy hat in the UK.
That's the worst of his offences, I think.
And kept fans waiting at a concert, which was very upsetting for all those 12-year-olds.
David, car crash
put your musical tastes in the private.
I had to wait 2 hours for him to come on stage. I was very disappointed.
Well, thanks.
I had to get to bed.
There's an interesting picture.
Well, David, we'll be back, not in 2 hours, but 27 minutes with another check of your world headlines. You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Phil Hahn, and Chloe Potter. Now, this week's Urbanist is sport themed. Now, sport can bring a vibrancy and splash of color to a neighborhood, not to mention the physical benefits for its people, as you can tell, Chloe, from my physique. But what happens when sports are in cars? High speed, high tech, but also high volume and high polluting cars.
Well, that is the conundrum facing the residents of such cities as Valencia, Singapore and Melbourne, all of whom gain financially when a motor race comes to town, but lose out on an uninterrupted week of normality, thanks to the crowds that tend to flood the streets and the hotels. Well, Ted Kravitz found out more from a resident of a street circuit city at last week's Brazilian Grand Prix.
The sound of the rain as it falls on the paddock roof here following a race of 24 Porsche 911 turbos around the Interlagos circuit in Sao Paulo. The Autodromo Carlos Pace, as it's known, is situated in the southern suburbs of the ever-expanding city of Sao Paulo, sandwiched, as the name Interlagos suggests, between two lakes, Guapiranga and Lake Billings. And while the racing activities are contained within these circuit walls, at other cities in the world, the racing takes to the streets. Valencia, Melbourne, Singapore, and of course the most famous street circuit of all, Monaco. with me to discuss the benefits, drawbacks, disruptions and distractions of Monaco is Laurent Dupin, currently works for Canal Plus in Formula One. Laurent, how are you? Tell me about Monaco. You used to live there, still live around there in the south of France. And what are the drawbacks and what are the advantages of having a street circuit, a race around the streets of Monaco for the residents?
For the residents, there are not so many advantages because a lot of people from Monaco, the Monégasques, are living even during the week of the Grand Prix because they can rent their terrace and so they can take some money and some advantage of it. But it's such a big mess, sorry for the word, but for 2 months before, they start to put the guardrails, the grandstand and everything. So the roads are narrower. There is less place to park the cars, and it's quite difficult. But in the end, people are usually very proud of it because it's very important for the glamour of Monaco and for the knowledge of Monaco around the world. But usually people try to say that they are not so happy because this is a way of thinking in southern France to never be happy of anything.
So at least with the rental of a balcony, or if you live somewhere near, then there's a financial advantage. But are there takers for that?
No, from people living in Monaco, except they are French, they don't pay any taxes. So.
Indeed, but what about the city itself, or the nation state, the principality? How does that change? First of all, as you said, in the months leading up to, because how much work actually has to be done on the infrastructure of the principality to get a street circuit ready?
It's a lot of work because there's guardrails all around 3 kilometers and a half, but of course on both sides. There's also a lot of bridges to put to go from one side of the other. There's a grand stage, which are quite huge, especially in the swimming pool area. So there's really a lot of work, and the roads are really not so large in Monaco, so all the trucks unloading stuff, so it's very difficult. And so it's not easy for people to live for 2 months before, and it's everything is taken away in only 3 weeks, so it's much more faster to pack everything instead of putting everything in place.
And then of course there's the noise.
Yeah, because you can hear the Formula One cars for at least 10 kilometers, depending on the wind. And so usually people are complaining when the session starts very early. So it's not the case of Formula One, but when there is a Formula One 3.5 or GP2 starting at 8, this is a bit annoying for people in Monaco.
What about the benefits, if there are any? The restaurants are always full, the bars?
Yes, but usually Monaco is always full of tourists from April to October. So it doesn't bring much more, I think, but it's just during the year, maybe a lot of people come to Monaco because they see it on TV with the yacht, the big boats, and the prince, and they think that so many people in Monaco want to drive around a lap of the track, even in August when there's not anything left from the Grand Prix, and we see that, and there's even a company renting Ferraris to drive around the track for one lap, because it's such a myth, this Grand Prix.
And then they get stuck in the traffic?
Yes, usually on first gear is the more they can do.
And when the race is actually there, how does the city close down in so much as what the residents can do? Do the police tell them, you can't go here, this road is shut, so people have trouble getting to school and to work?
Yes, you have to get a pass to access to your house that you have to take from the Automobile Club of Monaco a few weeks before. And the roads are closed in the morning, usually until 6 or 7 o'clock at night. But at least you can drive at night, which is not the case in Singapore, for example. And for work and for school, they close during the weekend, because usually the Monaco Grand Prix is on a bank holiday, Assumption Fair, I don't know in English, but... And when it's not the case, anyway, the company say to the people, to the employees, you cannot work, so put 2 days of holiday on Thursday, Friday, because it's nonsense. You cannot work in this condition. Everything is closed and nearly impossible to reach.
I want to ask you about other sport in Monaco in a moment, but every year that people go to Monaco, they'll see there is always new building. Some of the big building companies in Monaco, whether it's Pastor et Fils or whatever, are building new apartment blocks. How much do they market those apartment blocks with saying, do you know, if you buy a place here or rent a place, you will have a little view of the track as well?
I don't know the impact because Monaco is such a is famous also. The apartments are so expensive. Even the Monegas people cannot buy apartments if they have a normal job because not everybody is very rich in Monaco. So I'm not sure that the new flats are sold with saying a view on the Grand Prix. It's much more view on the sea 365 days a year.
Okay, let's talk about the other sport and how the other sport contributes or otherwise to Monegasque life. Big football team. Were quite famous and have indeed made it to the Champions League final a few years ago now. What's the name of the stadium? Where is it in town? And how much does it affect life in Monaco or contribute to it?
The stadium is called Stade Louis II, as a prince of 100 years ago in Monaco. And it's in the new part of Monaco, Fontvieille, which was built on the sea around 40 years ago. So it's not around the track. Well, Monaco is only 2 kilometers square, so it's not that big, but at least it's not in the same place as a racing track. And there's not so much enthusiasm around the team in Monaco because football is usually a popular sport, so people living in Monaco are not very much into it. And there's only 30,000 inhabitants in Monaco, and the stadium is 17,000 seats. So it would mean half of the people will have to go to the stadium. So this is why the stadium is not usually full or quite never. It's more people coming from Nice or from the surrenders and to come and try to make this this football club live and try to be a bit enthusiastic.
Laurent, thank you so much. Of course, with the popularity of the Monaco Grand Prix, one thing you can be sure of is that it'll be never short of visitors. For Monocle in Sao Paulo, I'm Ted Kravitz.
Wonderful sound that
lovely
is.
Sound.
You're listening to Midori House, and after this, we're going to meet a writer who wants us all to get rid of all of our stuff.
Oyuna, Comme des Garçons, Armadillo, Porter. The Monocle shops feature carefully curated collections from brands around the world, consisting of unique and exclusive collaborations with Monocle's designers and editors, as well as every issue of Monocle, right back to issue one. Hong Kong, London, New York and Toronto, the Monocle shops cover all your travel, home, sartorial and reading needs. Go to monocle.com/shop to explore more.
Cityscapes have inspired filmmakers for generations, and this year we sent a film crew to the Architecture Film Festival in Rotterdam to explore common themes found in building real and imaginary worlds.
In film, you can tell what's behind the walls. You can tell about the conflicts people have, the social aspects. And as filmmakers, in essence, are interested more or less in those conflicts, you can tell what's behind the facade.
Passion, obsession, idealism, architecture on film. Now playing in the films menu on monocle.com.
And welcome back. You're listening to Midori House with me, Phil Hahn, and Chloe Potter. The time is 8:43 here in London. Now, do you ever feel overrun and overwhelmed by the amount of stuff you own? Well, in particular, the stuff you own that you stuff into cupboards and never seem to use. Well, you are not alone, and you'll be pleased to hear that a revolution of a kind is approaching that could potentially help you cleanse your lifestyle, Chloe.
Yes, where the accumulation of things used to be the way in which we all enjoyed ourselves, it's now begun to stress us out. So what's the solution? Well, it's all about cathartically purging yourself of objects and adopting a more minimal lifestyle. Testament to the trend are the hugely popular blogs by self-proclaimed minimalists Ryan Nicodemus and Joshua Fields Milburn, who've become lifestyle pin-ups after downsizing their own lives. Well, now a new book, Stuffocation, has documented and reflected on this growing trend. And we're delighted to say that James Warman, the author of Stuffocation, is here in the studio with us, hopefully with all of the answers, James.
Certainly some of the answers. We'll see what we can do about all of
them. You came in looking very minimalist.
Yeah.
You don't have a lot of bags or coats or anything. Very streamlined.
Well, I'm touched. Thank you very much. My aim was to come in with working the stuffocation look. Yeah.
James, your thesis is that we've got the happiness equation the wrong way round. Explain what you mean by that.
It's a really great starting point, because I think at the heart of the book is the idea of happiness. And I think the heart of all of our lives is the question we ask ourselves, what should we do in order to be happy? And for the 20th century, I think that answer was we should be materialistic. Mm. It made loads of sense because the 20th century started in scarcity. Society didn't have enough stuff. We didn't have enough things. We didn't have central heating. So becoming materialistic and being materialistic was an incredibly positive thing to do because it created abundance, the abundance that someone like myself has grown up into. The thing is, that answer doesn't work anymore for a whole bunch of reasons. And that is the problem that I wrap up into this word stuffocation. And would you like me to talk through those different
reasons? Absolutely.
Well, James, we surely still like our stuff, don't we? You know, we still love going shopping. We love buying new clothes. We love buying a new TV, maybe a new iPad. Just look at all the stuff that we seem to love, even though, you know, it may not be 1980, it's 2013. So do we really have the equation wrong?
We certainly have the equation wrong. The book is not about giving up all of our stuff. It's that we have too much stuff. And it's kind of really about where to draw the line. So we want to get rid of loads of stuff, but not all of it. So don't throw the baby out with the bathwater.
It's about carefully curating your collection of things.
You don't need to be quite so specific. yes, if you do it really well, you curate your stuff. So as a great example, actually, my wife went to the H&M Isabel Marant
pre-sale.
And my wife came back with a fantastic cardigan for me last week, which is great, partly because I also got rid of a cardigan the week before. So it is about having things and enjoying the things we have, but it's about having not too many things, because too much stuff, a clutter is disastrous for our health. It just doesn't make us happy.
James, you've got a really interesting perspective on this, which I think is so true and is evident from the social media storm that we all now live in. And that is that what we get off on now is experiences rather than stuff. It's all about saying where you've been, what you've experienced, and finding happiness through that rather than showing off about a new car. You're showing off about the country you visited or the person you met.
Yeah, there's been an incredible change with the growth of social media. It's completely changed our world in so many ways, of course. But one of the crucial ways, I think, and that's so relevant to the thesis in the book, Stuffocation, is that in the 20th century, uniquely, we lived in cities. And in cities, obviously we live in cities now, but we started to live in cities in the 20th century where we didn't know other people. And so it became very important to say who we were, express who we were through the things that we had. So if you had a big car that you parked with your own name, you know, in the car park, or if you had a really fancy handbag or a nice pair of shoes, the people around you would see that and they would get an idea of who you were in terms of your social status. And status is incredibly important to animals and to us as humans. And in the 21st century, with the growth of social media, what we do has become much more important than what we have. Because if you think about, if you tweet about or you post a picture on Instagram or you put a status update on Facebook that says, I'm on a ski lift in Chamonix, I'm on the roof of my Riad in Marrakesh looking at the sun setting, think of the status that you get from that and the people that will know about the fact that you're doing that through Facebook or Instagram or Twitter are the kind of people you actually want to know about what you're doing rather than the anonymous people who might see what you have.
But so, isn't the point still the same? It's just a more modern version of it. So instead of showing off our stuff, we want to show off the photos that we've been, the places that we've been. So it still is just about showing off, isn't it?
Showing off sounds so negative.
Status, it does.
Status is really important to people. If you have more status, people laugh at your jokes more. You meet and find a better partner. You have more fun in life. You get paid more. So status is incredibly important.
So status is important to our happiness.
Absolutely. Yeah, status is important to our happiness and our health. So the shift from things to, or having things to doing something, it's not a negative thing. It's just it's an evolution and a development and a really positive one.
James, I want to get down to the nitty gritty. I mentioned two minimalist, so-called minimalist lifestyle bloggers in the introduction. They have taken it to the extreme, haven't they? This new minimalist approach. But what can the likes of us do? What's the first step on the road to happiness through not having too much stuff?
Okay. Those guys, Ryan and Joshua, are fantastic. And I think they have gone that extreme way. And there are millions that are trying to do that. But for many of us, it's a little bit extreme to exist with 50 things, 100 things, 288 things. If you count your things, it's you suddenly realize how many things you have. The first thing, the very simple thing to do is maybe to choose a particular cupboard in your house and to look at the things that you haven't used for the last year. To start with your socks, for example, to start with your shirts or your blouses or whatever it is and say,
start small.
I haven't worn this for ages. Or the other alternative is to play, I think it was the Brewster's Millions game. I don't know if you remember that movie, but he had to spend something like £1 million in a month and have nothing tangible to show at the end of it. Mm. So you could spend a month not having anything new that you could hold, but spending all your money on experiences rather than stuff.
But there is an ethical approach behind us not wanting to get rid of stuff, isn't it? It's that we don't want to waste things.
But if it's just sitting there doing nothing, then it is wasting in the first place.
That's what we need to accept. Okay, we'll start small.
Thankfully, we won't be on those reality TV shows about hoarders, will we?
Definitely
we'll
not.
Be okay. No. James Wallman, author of A Stuffocation, thanks very much for joining us here in the studio.
Now, sadly, we're approaching the end of the show. In a moment, we'll be reviewing the French press, though, with our producer, Daphne Denis. But ahead of that, since we started the show in Egypt and we're ending in France, we thought we'd play you a song by France's most iconic Egyptian singer, Dalida. This is Salma Ya Salama. That was Salma Ya Salama by Dalida.
And you are indeed listening to Midori House with me, Phil Hahn, and Chloe Potter. We're joined now by Monocle's Daphne Denis, who is here to review some of the French front pages. Daphne, are you do you like clutter?
it's a good question, Phil.
I've seen your desk.
Well, I see that you see yours, and I have to say yours is not that, you know,
it's very
empty.
Tidy.
It's not that tidy.
Oh, I think Phil wins the award for the most minimalist out of all of us.
Thank you very much,
out
Chloe.
Of all
loyalty.
Of us. I was thinking, though, you did go and buy the iPhone 5S just after it came out and
Anyways,
got rid of your iPhone 5.
Let's have a look at some of the French front pages this morning. Where should we begin?
We are going to begin with a meeting against racism for Christiane Taubira, who's our Minister of Justice in France. She's been the victim of really violent and disgusting attacks about the fact that she's black, basically. And the Socialist Party, which has been super divided lately, has actually rallied around her and done this really nice gesture of sort of saying, we're really standing with her and we can't deal with these attacks.
Is this going to be the straw that breaks the camel's back, as it were? Is more going to be done to tackle this seeming rise in racism, xenophobia, intolerance in France and elsewhere?
Because in Italy as well, they had the country's first black minister, and who was being the victim of racist attacks as well.
I mean, it's very difficult because in a way, France hasn't really realized that we had these people. We didn't realize that these people existed in France, because in France we had a right wing party that was in power for so long, and now the people that come out and are so vocally against this woman, Christiane Taubira, wouldn't say these things when the right was in power. So now they're using this as sort of a way to voice their opposition to the Socialist Party, but they're saying awful, awful things. I mean, there was the cover of extreme right-wing magazine that compared her to a monkey. I mean, it's ridiculous and it's
really nasty,
despicable. And I'm pleased to see that for once the Socialist Party standing together for a good cause.
Another story, a chief executive who's setting a positive example.
Well,
arguably.
Kind of forced to do so. I mean, I don't think he really wanted to. But yes, Peugeot's CEO, Philippe Varin, is retiring, and he has said that he's not going to take 21 million that he was supposed to get for his retirement. That's after, obviously, huge protests, since he has cut 11,000 jobs and they want to cut 125 million euros a year on the on the company. So
it's a hefty retirement package.
Quite an astonishing package, yeah.
Yeah.
And interestingly, a debate on prostitution is taking centre stage.
Yes, absolutely. The French National Assembly is debating whether to penalise the clients of prostitutes. And on Le Monde here, you have a big debate page where on one side you have a man who explains that he has been a client of prostitutes three times and explains why he doesn't think that penalizing clients is going to change anything. And on the other side, you have a former prostitute who says that she's in favor of penalizing clients because she thinks that's a way to get women out of slavery, basically.
Interesting discussion points there. And Daphne, you have finally one more story for us as well.
An annoying rap song.
Well, it's not that annoying. It's just quite funny to see this. It's a rap song that's saying that they want to burn the magazine Charlie Hebdo, which, I don't know if you remember, made big caricatures of Islam and of the Prophet Muhammad. And in this song, they said, oh, yeah, we want to burn that magazine down. And the magazine is really angry. For once, the magazine that laughs at everyone every single day is really, really angry. And they're saying, I don't understand, this is awful, you're so violent. But they do that all the time, so it's quite nice to see for once.
I love that it's come in the form of a rap song and that's got its attention. It's done its job.
Excellent stuff, Daphne. Thanks very much for coming in and having a look through this morning's French front pages. And thank you, Daphne, as well, for being such a talented producer, doing some double duty here. Our researchers were Fernando Agosto Pacheco and Nabiha Iqba, and our studio manager was Bill Luti. Up next, after the news, is Culture with Robert Bound. Stay tuned for the briefing at midday in London. That's 7 a.m. in Toronto. Clemency Britton-Hill and I will be back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow. But for now, from me, Phil Hahn.
And me, Chloe Potter. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
Why this watch? This watch is a witness. A witness to words that moved nations. It's dead men faster, further. It's been worn by luminaries, visionaries, champions. It doesn't just tell time. It tells history. Rolex.